Hi, everybody. This is Ian Dinsmore, one of the co-hosts of the Boss Hoggin podcast. My other co-host, Nick James, couldn't be here. He's here in spirit, I'm sure, or he might just be around my house. I don't know. He's kind of a creeper. But I wanted to give you guys a little bit of a more formal introduction to the Boss Hoggin podcast. This is our first and inaugural podcast. We're going to be touching on a weekly basis from everything from the Seattle Seahawks to, you know, local Seattle sports in general. We'll probably be more heavily focused on WSU, the Washington State Cougars, from a college perspective, rather than the Huskies, because we hate them and they're our arch rivals. But from there, we're going to touch on all things pop culture that are really interesting us are interesting to us at the time, I should say. In this inaugural podcast, we actually touch on a bunch of the position groups of the Seahawks that are, you know, giving us pause at the moment, and try our best not to allude to the Tennessee Titans game, which we've all seen at this point. And then we transition into a discussion of Blade Runner 2049 and our expectations for that movie. On a weekly basis, you can definitely expect the audio quality to get better. You know, we're testing this out. You can definitely expect our podcast hosting skills to get a lot better as well. But we're really excited for you guys to be listening. I can't wait to continue to do this on a weekly or bi-weekly basis. I don't know. We haven't figured that out either. But thank you again for listening. Really hope you enjoy this this very first podcast.
Your host, alongside Ian Dinsmore, this is the Boss Hoggin podcast.
Welcome to the Boss Hoggin podcast.
First time, I'm sure very few people will hear this at all. But we are going to open up with talking about the Seattle Seahawks and the, I guess, community that we follow pretty closely online.
It's like a loose use of the word community, but I mean,
It's definitely a community, I think. They get along like siblings most of the time, and they have a penchant for what I call pants pissing. They look at what is one of the best teams in the league consistently year in, year out, and they find ways to freak themselves out, even though there is an established pattern of starting slow during the season and working things out and working kinks out as they go along and just not recognizing that at all.
No, I know. And this is the dumbest part about the community, and also maybe the best part about it is the ability to troll these guys. Like, it's nonstop bitching. And we're talking like Jimmy Graham has two bad games. By the way, people, last year he started with two bad games as well. And then had back-to-back 100-yard receiving games and ended up with 923 yards or something on the season. I mean, it was that's the prime example of this. I mean, these guys will go on Twitter rants and talk themselves into these corners that are incredible. And it's like a crisis of conscience every week. And it's easily my favorite part of reading Twitter. Especially post Seahawks win, which is really bizarre. Like, I know the Niners game sucked, but man, I mean, it felt like the world was collapsing in on itself, even though we won a game. So, you know, I guess that's kind of the way it goes.
Well, it is a really, really favorite part of my of watching the Seahawks and being part of this community, and a community that I really, really like, by the way. It's you know, we have really, really smart writers locally. I guess they don't necessarily have to live locally, but that follow the Hawks closely and do a really good job of breaking things down week in, week out. This podcast is going to be a lot of commenting on that. We'll try to keep the shade and the fucking the back body to a minimum, but it's going to happen on occasion. And if you know, we'll reference, you know, different feeds from time to time, different blogs from time to time. We may get the, I guess, the ID of the writer wrong, or not know the exact, I guess, purveyor of the knowledge or like that. So that's apologies for that in advance. We'll clean it up as we go along. But, you know, we're already talking about Jimmy Graham right now. Let's keep going. I think the prevailing opinion, I think, if there is such a thing, is that things are not going well with Jimmy Graham, which is true. Things aren't going very well at the moment with Jimmy Graham. For a couple reasons, I think Working them in the office has been harder than we all thought it ever would be. He seems to perform in fits and starts, will disappear from games, will dominate some games like we saw last year in Buffalo. But I guess the frustration is understandable. I don't think we're there yet to trade him, especially when you're really not going to get anywhere near his potential value back.
Yeah, and I totally agree with that, and but also the trade discussion seems moot at this point. I mean, we'd have to wait till like week 7 or week 8 for him to have what like 5 decent games. Like this is the like classic stock market conversation. Like you'd be buying Jimmy Graham at like pennies on the dollar at this point. It would be so pointless of John to go out into the market right now and like attempt to figure this out. It's not gonna happen.
I assume you mean our good friend John Schneider.
Oh yeah. Oh, yeah. I should probably mention his entire name.
Friend of the pod, John Schneider.
Yeah. Hopefully friend of the pot eventually.
With Jimmy Graham, this offense is grinding its gears. There's no two ways about it. We watched them barely get past a pretty, I would say, marginally talented San Francisco team is probably the best way to put it. And then we saw that same. We saw the Rams go and put up 41 points in week three on Thursday night. And why in the hell can't we even put up 13 points on this team is beyond almost all of us. We just know that they are not performing in a way that we certainly know they can. And the offensive line, kind of moving on a bit, the offensive line is obviously been the flashpoint for going on. This is the third year, and not many folks are seeing much light at the end of the tunnel. What have you seen so far?
Yeah, I mean, I guess like, what's the point in even kind of relitigating this on a week-to-week basis? Like, we know that they suck. Like, adding Odey Obuchi in there for Mark Lewinsky, I actually do think is a minor upgrade. But I just don't think there's nothing we could possibly add to this conversation at this point that's going to shed any light on this. I mean, the simple fact was Glow wasn't very good last year, and then we moved him to the other side, and he's bad now. These other guys have what a combined like 8 starts together. I mean, collectively at their positions. Obviously, Jokel has more starts, but not at left guard. I think we're going on 6 or 7 starts potentially.
This will be his seventh start.
Yeah.
And Afidi having his, first taste of NFL right tackle. He was a right tackle at Texas A&M. Britt, obviously the most experienced at the center position, starting all last year. And Reese Odhiambo, college left tackle, that's finding it tough sledding in the NFL at the left side, facing all those fierce pass rushers. This is not a Seahawks specific problem. This is an issue in the first few weeks of the season across the NFL. I mean, we could probably count on one hand, good offensive lines that have performed consistently well this year. I think probably, I guess Green Bay's done fine. It looks like with some trouble in Atlanta, but overall they've acquitted themselves well. I think down in Oakland they've been very good, and obviously Dallas being kind of the recognized class of all these offensive lines. The rest of the league is in trouble. Definitely, we can talk about college not preparing these guys for the league, but I think you're probably talking about a that's not really discussed enough, more than just technique and learning the game in college, or learning a very different game, different way to play offensive line in college. I think you could probably point towards the athleticism gap on the offensive line. I mean, you are seeing every single year as the draft comes through, you see, guys with, spark levels, spark scores, very, very high spark scores across the defensive line, across positions, across the defensive line, both edge rushers and defensive tackles. And now you're trying to match that with subpar athletes, athletes who just strictly do not, definitionally do not measure up to their defensive counterparts.
I think it was Davis Sue on Twitter that brought this up watching the Thursday night game, but DeForest Buckner and Solomon Thomas, I think he mentioned them by name and said those guys would have been offensive tackles years ago, and now they're playing on the defensive line and they're just freaking monsters. And watching them go up against these lackeys that the Rams have outside of Whitworth, who is a kind of making me sad because he's so good and we could have had him in the offseason. But going up against those guys, I mean, they're so stout and they're so big and long, and we completely lack that now on the edges.
Oh, agreed. It's speaking just from a standpoint, I'm really hoping, I have high hopes that Odhiambo can get improved as the season goes along, and I'm sure he will. I mean, he'll never be a Pro Bowl left tackle, but I do hope that he can become functional in the run game. And if not the run game, maybe just keep, really, really good pass rushers from dominating games against the Seahawks. That would be preferable. Also, something that I wanted to touch on real quick is how did the Seahawks go from having one of the deepest wide receiver cores in the league to going with essentially three proven performers and not much beyond that? I realize that preseason isn't the same thing. I realize that just because someone has a good preseason, i.e. Kaysen Williams, doesn't mean that they're going to be able to produce. I don't believe he's been active yet in Cleveland yet, as good as he looked. But I do feel like we have seen some weaknesses there. I don't think Amaro Darbo's played poorly. I don't think he's got a lot of opportunities. Played fine last week. Got a PI call and a pretty big reception. Tanner McAvoy, however, seen a couple drops, a drop in each game. Not looking like the most natural receiver out there. You certainly like his ability on special teams. But I mean, I hate to do another postmortem on the tough, cut downs from a wide receiver, but it does look like they're lacking a little bit in the back end of that position group. What do you think you've seen so far?
Yeah, I think the route trees too need to come into account here, because when we've been watching these breakdowns over, on Twitter and on NFL Network over the last week, and the Seahawks were running these super deep route trees against the Niners, and route trees that require Russ to stand back there for a good 3 or 4 seconds. And dude does not have 3 or 4. He might have a second and a half. And that's a huge, huge struggle in this offense at this point. And as soon as we get into 11 personnel, we start running, and I'm not even talking hurry up at this point, just running kind of like basic up-tempo concepts where you snap the ball with like 25 seconds left on the play clock. Like that kind of stuff seems to work. And I don't know why we wait until the end of the first half and the fourth quarter to start doing it.
Agreed. I think, philosophically, you're looking at, Pete Carroll wanting to try to keep his opportunities, not have his defense out there all game long. And you worry about the hurry up as in I guess the problem is scoring too quickly, which I would take at this point, not a problem. I would deal with the consequences of putting points on the board and moving down. But, he would probably look at it like, three and outs. But I don't see a huge difference between a 2 minute three and out and a 30 second three and out. It's just, there's no consistency. There's nothing to really hang your hat on for the Seahawks offensively. Run game works and fits and starts. The only real pass plays that we have that are effective tend to be broken plays or rollouts by Russell Wilson. So I really don't see where the improvement's going to come from just yet. That said, I do think we will win football games in this fashion until they figure it out. The defense is so strong. I heard on a podcast last week, I think it was Hawk Blogger, maybe he was talking to Softy on the radio, where he was a little bit underwhelmed by the defensive performance, which, to each their own.
I don't know about that.
I think what we expect when they added Sheldon Richardson, we were going to see them collapsing pockets, breaking up plays, blowing up plays every time or every other time. That's really not the way this defense works. This defense is about fits. It's about being gap disciplined. It's about making them drive the field on you. It's not necessarily about putting up giant sack numbers because they won't. I mean, Clint McDonald was an extremely effective player in 2013 from the interior providing rush, and he got 5.5 sacks that year, I think. I might be off on that number, but I think that's the number. I think when you're going to look at Sheldon Richardson, you're going to be looking at a guy who's going to be applying pressure, blowing up plays in the run game, and keeping quarterbacks from climbing the pocket and carving up the Seahawks downfield. I could not be happier with the Seahawks defensive performance so far, especially by the young players, Shaq Griffin being chief among them.
Yeah, and honestly, I realized we gave up, it was like 159 yards rushing against the Niners. It was essentially on two chunk plays to Carlos Hyde. One of them was 61 yards. I think the other was 29. He ended with like 114 or something. There were some scrambles mixed in, and backups had a few decent runs. But David Bass, is David Bass? Keep me honest.
David Bass is off the team.
No, I know, but he got cut.
Oh, yeah.
Essentially because he got caught inside. On that 61-yard run, and completely fucked his chances of staying in this defensive rotation.
Pete Carroll likes his run fits, and he does not take kindly to folks who do not stay gap disciplined in this defense. You know, there was been several really good players that have come and gone from Seattle that have had good careers elsewhere. Jay Howard, who was a draft pick in the fourth round out of Florida. T.Y. McGill, who's been bouncing around rosters for a while, but at times has been productive. I think the Colts was his last stint that he was performing well. You will not stay on this team if you do not, first and foremost, do your job. There's one player in this defense on the front line, I think in the front seven, that really is able to freelance a bit. That's Michael Bennett. There's one in the background, or the defensive backfield that does it. Earl Thomas, but both those guys are so effective, and I think the defense actually accounts for Bennett to freelance a bit by other guys staying disciplined and controlling their gaps. I believe the wide receiver core.
All right.
And essentially the offense in general. No, the defense, we picked it up. I'm psyched for the defense, man. I think the potential is there. If you want to pick nits, I would say I'd like to get a few more sacks, a few more pressures, but I think a little bit of it goes to, Aaron Rodgers is, week one, we harassed, I think, the way you have to harass Aaron Rodgers, which is keeping him inside the pocket, keeping that really efficient movement that he has inside the pocket and be able to move just outside of it and absolutely carve you up. I think they did a really, really nice job of that. It was as close to a perfect performance as you can really get, minus a couple offsides and a couple BS penalties. I think they acquitted themselves well.
And I mean, really what it comes down to, didn't they make it – they had one red zone trip.
Yes, essentially.
And it was gifted to them by us.
At the six-yard line with a fumble, yeah. So defense, I'm not too worried about anything. If I had to pick nits, though, I'd say I'd love to see Frank Clark use some of that, exceptional ability to really, really take over games. You know, it's one thing that we haven't seen thus far. 10 sacks last year, a very good player, a guy who's going to make a ton of money when his contract comes up, or if they decide to extend him next year. I hope they do. But so far, he has not really taken over games the way you expect a guy with his talent level to do it.
No, but I do think this is a perfect point in the podcast to introduce the podcast world, our 12 loyal listeners, to our Frank Clark nickname.
Yes.
Detective Frank Clark.
He is Detective Frank Clark. He has always been Detective Frank Clark since we drafted him.
Yep. No lives matter.
No lives matter
to Detective Frank Clark.
And that's not a PC thing, but it's what we believe.
exactly. It's just true. Yeah.
So if you hear the terms DFC, it stands for Detective Frank Clark. We will not go into why we call him Detective Frank Clark. Just know that
everybody has their reasons.
We all have their reasons.
We all have our own reasons.
And I'll tell you what, he's cleaning up the streets, and he plays by his own rules. You could try to take his badge and gun, but you cannot take his license. edit this part out. Should have thought
I'm
that
definitely
over.
Not going to edit that out.
anyway,
you were searching for something there.
If you could have seen my face, you would have seen the sheer panic of not knowing what to say.
I mean,
next,
it's amazing. We are drinking red wine at noon while recording this on a Saturday. So
it's afternoon.
Stand to reason, we'd start to stumble over our words eventually.
Plenty more where that came from. What else about Instead of, okay, you know, no, I just insulted a lot of the people that we follow on Twitter by saying pants pissing, things like that. And we just basically did that for the last 15 minutes. So what are you excited about moving forward?
I got me. Yeah. We're like, we're going to start this podcast. We're going to be super positive about the Hawks. Now let's talk about how much we hate like nine position groups.
How much we hate this team.
But we are so unbelievably spoiled by this team. And I think that is the toughest thing to reconcile
like as far as like just being around the people that follow this team.
Yeah, I mean, I these people, a lot of them had to be around in the 90s.
Oh yeah, I would hope so.
Following this team in the 90s and the early 2000s, or the early aughts, as it were, and like mid Holmgren on, and we'll forget about the Mora year.
Yeah,
I mean, come on.
It's been great. I mean, it's, you know, we've seen, you know, we got to the Super Bowl one time, and you know, the 2005 season felt pretty jobbed after that game. And 2013 was an absolutely orgasmic, you know, absolutely awesome feeling to watch the way they won that game. And, you know, in retrospect, you know, of course they dominated the Broncos. Of course they won 41-8. Was that what it was? 43-8. You look at how stacked that team was in retrospect. You know, we didn't know at the time. Everything felt so, I mean, we lived and died with every one of those games. I mean, I don't remember feeling as satisfied or as good in my life than when Richard Sherman tipped the ball and Malcolm Smith intercepted it. It was so fucking perfect in every way. It was perfect.
And what's, you're making me want to put that Blu-ray in right now and watch all the playoff games. But that season, I remember driving home from my cousin's wedding in Eastern Oregon, and we were driving through like the Tri-Cities or something, and I barely had cell phone service, and I was trying to refresh. We were playing Tampa Bay at home. Tampa Bay starting Mike Glennon as a rookie, I think. They were 0-7. They were an embarrassing, like, they were just a garbage team.
They were a bad team.
Garbage team. I think Lovie Smith was their coach. Who was their coach? Anyway,
I think it was Lovie Smith, yeah.
Yeah. They were really bad. I was refreshing my phone, looking at it. It was, we were down 21-0.
I remember that.
The second or third quarter.
The Tim Wright just destroying us in the end zone.
Crushing us. That
game. Yeah. Mike Glennon taking us apart piece by piece.
And my dad's like trying to console and I'm like 28. Or like he's like, oh, it's going to be all right, you maniac. And we like pulled into like an Olive Garden or something, like to just like get a drink and like anything.
That would be the Yakima Olive Garden, I assume.
Oh yeah, Yakima Olive Garden. I it was somewhere over there. We sit down and we slowly start to watch them grind their way back. And I feel like we're in like peak Seahawks grinding mode at this point, where like every game feels like a slog, and like we're not getting the like young team 55-0 against the Cardinal blowouts anymore. And I just don't feel like we're going to get them anymore. And okay. But even a 21-7 win right now feels like a blowout.
Those are the anomalies. You know, those are the ones a lot of us remember, you know, that when Russell Wilson, I believe that was his rookie season, going to Buffalo and just destroying that team with the read option and his mobility, things just clicking on all cylinders. But those days are over. You know, that's not, I mean, Marshawn Lynch was a big part of that. And I don't think we're ever going to see a player like him again, probably in the league, you know, after he retires for the second time. And Russell Wilson certainly isn't going to be sneaking up on anybody with his skill set. I think the league's done a nice job of containing what he does. I think we got to find a way. The Seahawks have to find a way to use what defenses do against us against them.
I think we're allowed to say we.
I disagree.
Why not?
I'm going to check it. We're not going to get into this now, Ian. No. But
it's bullshit.
The way they contain him in the pocket, the way
I say we,
the way they contain him in the pocket, the way edge rushers have to approach him, or at least used to have to approach him, was keep him in there. Don't collapse the sides. Stay contained. Make sure he doesn't escape on you. I think teams have done a good job of that overall the last couple of years, but in the meantime, use that against them. I mean, every time a defense makes a choice, make them pay for that choice if you can. If not, every single time, at least try to do it consistently, at least once a drive. I don't necessarily think that Russ is playing his best ball right now. I hope he gets better. There's been talk about a shoulder injury, his mechanics being a little bit off, him having the yips back there a little bit. I think that's
I think he definitely has the yips. I will say one thing we will absolutely address, if it's a thing, is that loopy-ass delivery that we saw in the Niners game. Like, we didn't see it in the Green Bay game. And I'm still wondering if it had something to do with the rain. I hate making the rain an excuse, but he sucked in the rain for his entire career.
He has not been good in the rain. He's not been good on grass. He's, you know, there's...
Those slow tracks, man. He's been bad on slow tracks.
Yeah, and I think... this is nothing new for him. He started slow his rookie year. He started slow pretty much every year that he's been in the league. The Seahawks have kind of followed suit. It's not just on him, I don't think. But I don't know if we're going to get we're ever going to get a team that finishes or that starts fast in Seattle, at least under Pete Carroll. I think that that's not very important to him. I think he'd like to be good early in games. He'd like to be good early in seasons. I think that he'd much rather finish strong. And they have done that almost – every year that he's been here, that Pete Carroll's been here.
Yeah, his like ridiculous, you know, like Tony Robbins, you know, like inspirational shit does track.
Yes.
Like,
it does.
It's happened. His career has a perfect trajectory of that. Like all of those stupid things and stupid sayings and win forever and all that crap. And you can't win in the first quarter, in the
second quarter, in the third quarter. But
his USC teams followed the exact same pattern.
Yep.
With the exact same amount of devastating losses.
You know, it's. I guess I'm gonna. You know, I'm guilty of this in the past, especially the year of the Super Bowl and the year following the Super Bowl, of living and dying with every Seahawks loss. It certainly will ruin my day when they lose. I try not to let it affect me that much anymore. at least carry on into Monday and Tuesday.
It definitely still does, though.
No, I mean, I'm trying to be better about it. You know, I'll have a little freak out moment and be sad.
Long walk with the dog and burn a few heaters.
And
to bourbon.
Some bourbon on the back porch. In any case, I am not going to push the panic button on this team. They're too good defensively. They seem to be in a really, really good spot as a team, at least from what I've seen so far. Sherm is back to his kind of me against the world thing against me, and then instead of me against, you know, the offense. Hopefully that continues on. I really, really hope that the offense can put some points up against a really, really good team. Well, should we wrap this one for now and move on to...
I think we should, and I think let's give a tiny shout out to Hawks Twitter for going through like the seven stages of grief this week after a 12-9 victory over the 49ers and making it to acceptance by Friday. I'm gonna shout out Hawks Chronicle on Twitter at Hawks Chronicle because he gave me like a little bit of light yesterday and made me feel so much better about this season that we have been watching this team for 5 years.
Do what they do.
Five years with Russ, right?
Yeah.
Is this year six?
2012 was his draft year.
Yeah, so 5 years. So this is year five with Russ. We are looking at a team that has done this year in and year out. They're awesome every year. They've won 10-plus games every year since Russ has been the quarterback and since his defense has come together. Like, that should be celebrated, and I know we're spoiled now, and I know we have a lot of Amazon assholes at the game, so it doesn't feel like it's as loud. I guarantee you by the end of the season it will feel that way. I guarantee you if we can come out of Tennessee with a W, we're going to come back to CenturyLink on Sunday night and absolutely rip the whatever is left of the Indianapolis Colts, a new one, and it's going to feel so fucking good to do that.
Yeah, I agree. I'll second that. I will say I do understand, knowing how good this team has been in the past at certain points, watching them, you know, win by 3 points against the Niners is a fucking tough slog. But just try to put it all in perspective. Remember that this is a pretty uniformly consistent way to start the season for the Seahawks. They will get better. Everyone knows that we're not playing up to – the Seahawks are not playing up to their capabilities at this point. But I'll shout out another good follow that we have that I follow, Ben Baldwin, who does a nice job breaking down the running game and the offensive line. Going back to that for just a second, there's reason for hope. At least this year that we have options. Last year, there was no Odey Egbuchi. There was no Ethan Posick. There was no – I mean, if George Fent hadn't been hurt, we'd be looking at Reece Odhiambo as a top backup on the left side of both guard and tackle and feeling probably okay about that.
There was Jamarcus Webb and Bradley Sowell.
There was Bradley Sowell yeah. and Jamarcus Webb last year.
Options, baby.
There were no options last year. You know, we have – you know, Matt Tobin seemed to think that he might get some playing time this week, especially probably if Reece Odhiambo struggles. I wouldn't like to see that happen. I'd rather just see Reece be functional effective at the left tackle position, but well, it's asking a lot sometimes, especially with some of the guys they have on the front seven for Tennessee.
Yeah, so let's put a bow on this for this week and say that we are still very optimistic as the rest of Seahawks Twitter and land should be optimistic. This team is still really fun. Your quarterback's healthy this year. Last year we started by winning against the Dolphins 12-10 and then losing to the Rams 9-3 or something. And Russ could barely stand up straight because he was so injured after that Dolphins game. Not only to follow that up with another injury in week three. So just saying, we don't have to see Trayvon Boykin this year. In fact, he's not even on the team. Well, he's on the practice squad.
He's on the practice squad, yeah.
I mean, we don't even have to sniff that at this point. We have a healthy Russ. Hopefully we will keep an eye on that loopy delivery we saw that could be rain, you know, created, and he will be back to normal. We may see some more read option early to kind of get the running back's legs under him and get those guys like blasting off the ball on the offensive line and not going for cut blocks where you see all five linemen on their fucking faces.
I know we're wrapping up, but does Russ need to get hit? I mean, some guys need to get hit before they really start playing. I mean, Tom Brady's said he needs to get his clock clean a good one time before he really starts feeling in the game.
I mean, I didn't see it in any of the breakdowns last week, but he got hit a lot against the Niners.
He did get hit a lot. I guess
I don't know if he got like creamed like he did like by Clay Matthews in the NFC Championship game.
I saw one where he got lit up pretty good. I guess maybe not so much getting hit. Does he need to get out and run and get winded a bit and make that defense pay for with his legs to really start feeling it? That to me, that's what feels like might be necessary for this team, is not necessarily go out and say, okay, we're going to do up tempo and drive number two, and we're going to do up tempo and drive number five, and plan it out strategically. When he makes them pay, when he breaks off one for 15 to 25 yards and gets out of bounds and the defense is a little bit gassed at that point, maybe put the pedal on then. Not so much plan it out. I think it might be one of those things where if you feel them get back on their heels even a little bit, speed up the tempo, get the snap off in the next 15 seconds, don't let them sub, really make them pay for keeping their guys out there. That's what I would like to see this week, is just be a little bit more. I know it's probably being – you never want to be reactive, but if you see them starting to struggle to contain Russ – take advantage of it. Just try three or four plays in a row at a quicker tempo. Regroup after that.
I couldn't agree more.
It was a solid point. Solid take.
Yeah, solid take. It wasn't even that hot.
It was pretty lukewarm.
So from time to time here on the Boss Hog and Pod, we are going to dip into the world of pop culture, more specifically probably movies and television, because we watch a lot of them. I actually have I'm going to plug my own website on my own podcast, but my website, drunksunshine.com, I've been reviewing movies there for about 8 years. From time to time, we'll probably dip into the fun bag of what's coming out of Hollywood.
Fun bag indeed.
Yeah. I mean, it often isn't. For example, I did just see The Kingsman Golden Circle this week. And
sucks.
It was an absolute slog of a 2.5-hour movie. I mean, even the name makes
it's
me
a long
mad
movie
now after seeing it. And we won't spend any time on that.
I know what we are going to do. I'm going to take the reins right here. We are going to wrap up the Seahawks podcast before we move on to the movie one. We'll do our own separate intro for that. But what the hell is the name of that movie again? The Kingsman?
The Golden Circle.
The Golden Circle.
No, I know. It's dangerously close to The Golden Shower. And, I mean, honestly, the Kingsman movies are so kind of gross and mean. I'm surprised there isn't a Golden Shower. There is a shot in this movie that goes into a woman's vagina.
Like, what?
Just while a guy is fingering her. And I'm not even joking. Like, that is an actual scene, and like, props, I guess, for like going that far, but like, really bizarre. And it was like CGI'd, and there were like, it was
trying to,
it was upsetting.
Trying to figure out the, well, I mean, thank
he
God.
Had he had to plant a tracking device on her, but inside it had of to her. Land on a mucous membrane. He's not going to stick it up her nose. She'd totally figure that out. So instead he had to seduce her. And then rape her, I guess?
Finger blaster?
Like, it was really kind of gross. It was just gross. It was gross. Like, what is happening in this movie? It's so mean and
I guess if you have
angry.
To have a tracking device and maybe make – yeah, it's
the mucous membrane angle was very unnecessary.
What's wrong with Velcro?
Yeah, it could have just been, like, you have to, like, poke her with it. Like, I mean, like, and then it's in her.
Yeah.
But no, the mucous membrane angle is stupid. So today, though, we're going
to – I am glad that finger blasting is actually making an appearance, though, back in pop culture again.
Yeah,
I'm
glad finger blasting is making an appearance on our podcast in week one. I thought it would take a little bit longer than this. My grandma will love that. So we're going to dive into essentially five movies that we're excited about seeing leading up to award season. And the weird thing about award season is we just start to get hammered with Oscar bait movies. This year,
define Oscar bait to you, please. You're
so
the critic.
Oscar bait to me are movies with a lot of what I would call shine on them.
Shiny.
Where you see very good-looking actors in very expensive costumes in various forms throughout history, doing, you know, from biopics to very boring period pieces.
Strong redemption arcs, things like
yes,
that.
Yes, and very... There's a Jake Gyllenhaal movie coming out called Stronger, which apparently is very good, but it's about the Boston Marathon bombings. There will be several historical dramas that will come out that will look very beautiful and handsome and you know, have some sort of historical context that we have to reckon with. My problem with those movies is they're so obviously set up by Hollywood to come out at this time and be those Oscar bait movies.
Everyone's got their thoroughbred.
To get Benedict Cumberbatch a Oscar nomination for The Imitation Game. Like, The Imitation Game is such an eye roll of a movie. Like, that movie should be so much darker than it is, but instead they turn it into an inspirational slog. The King's Speech, a movie that won Best Picture, is the exact definition of Oscar bait.
Got
it. And every once in a while, the Oscars rise above that and award a movie like No Country for Old Men. You know, just cynical nihilists and all of us are celebrating. But it is rare that happens. But for today, we're going to look at five movies that we're excited about. And we will periodically check in, not only on these movies, but many more coming out as we make our way toward the end of the year. The first of these movies, and the one we'll probably spend the most time on, is Blade Runner 2049.
Blade Runner 2049.
It is
the gauze.
It is a movie not only with Smirk and Ryan Gosling in it, but it's a sequel to one of my favorite movies of all time, and one of Ridley Scott's masterworks, in my opinion, from the early 1980s.
Yeah, maybe his. I know he had some killers in there, but that might be his probably most beloved movie, I think. I mean, Aliens is up there too.
Yeah,
Alien.
Yeah, I would say Alien and that are probably 1 and 1A. I mean, people will ride for some later works like Gladiator and stuff, but I think these movies are far superior.
I would not.
And they also just put to shame his new Alien movies, but we won't go there. I wonder about Blade Runner 2049 being directed by Denis Villeneuve, who's made some of my favorite modern films, from Sicario to Arrival. Prisoners was fine, I guess.
Prisoners was a better than expected movie for me when I saw Prisoners. I was a little bit more affected by it than I thought I would. The performances were really, really strong, I think, by Jackman and that creepy little Paul Dano.
Oh, God, yeah.
Forgot about
Paul Dano.
Sicario is one I actually rewatched recently. My wife was out of town. I was just kind of batching out alone, and I watched and I'm putting Sicario on pretty late in the evening and finishing it all the way through.
It's exceptional. It's an incredible movie.
It is. from the very first scene with the house, with the bodies. I don't know how... I don't know about the logistics of that necessarily.
It's an upsetting scene, regardless of how like the contractors had to actually work out how to put those bodies.
Exactly, yeah. And how you were able to be inside that house for longer than about 5 seconds before you ended up gagging,
barfing everywhere. Yeah.
I know Emily Blunt got some shade for her performance in that movie.
I don't get that.
Did not see what the problem was at all.
I don't get that at all.
She did a good job. Josh Brolin was excellent. Of course, the actual Sicario, Benicio del Toro was incredible in that too.
His aesthetic actually lends itself really well to a Blade Runner sequel, and I think just from the way his movies develop so slowly and deliberately, and I think that's actually really good because Blade Runner 1 is under 2 hours long, but has such a deliberate pace, it feels longer than it is.
And
it's so dense. It's only an hour and 45 minutes. This movie is going to push 2 hours and 45 minutes, I think.
Wow.
Which I'm slightly scared of, and is going to subject us to a blind Jared Leto, really hamming it up. And you are going to find two of the biggest Jared Leto haters on the Boss Hogan pod.
If you, by
a magnitude of thousands, we hate this guy.
If you love to hate, or actually just hate to hate Jared Leto, I mean,
oh yeah, join us each week.
Yeah, please. We'll find the time. Jared Leto to me is I haven't seen the movie. None of us have. But it's this is my. What's the opposite of ideal? This is my nightmare scenario for Jared Leto to be in this this movie with this level of anticipation.
Absolutely.
And this kind of responsibility to hold up its end of a beloved classic.
This would be akin to him being in the Star Wars sequel at this point, in my opinion. I think this Blade Runner sequel has a level of anticipation and hype at this point.
I think so.
That could equal the Star Wars movies.
I think so. I think it does, not necessarily just because it's Blade Runner, the original is so beloved. It is beloved, but not like Star Wars is. I think what's really crept up this, or kind of amped up this anticipation of this Blade Runner 2049 is the quality of the trailer so far. I think they've done an awesome job capturing the mood, I think, of the original. The original, not a beautiful film, a visually striking film, but a very grimy, dirty one, creates a very kind of a hellish cityscape in its world building. Not a place you'd want to live in. It looks like things have even doubled down from there. It looks, the future looks absolutely nightmarish, bleaker than it did in Blade Runner. Mm-hmm. Less, I guess, maybe going from a cramped
LA.
A cramped LA to one where people, it looks like people would be living in shelters, where there's
out on the outskirts.
Yeah.
It looks much more like a desert landscape than that kind of grimy, it almost looked very inspired by Southeast Asia, actually.
Yeah.
When you can see some of those markets up close and how dense and kind of claustrophobic they can feel when
Absolutely.
You're walking through it.
Yeah.
That's kind of what the LA of Blade Runner 1 felt like.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you add in some flying cars and some very large buildings built by the evil corporations. But it's going to be interesting to see. And I remember watching Blade Runner, and obviously the big question that we had was, is Harrison Ford a replicant?
Right.
And replicants don't age, so I feel like the trailer basically tells us that that's not the case.
Right.
I do wonder what the newfangled mystery will be here. I don't think, with Ridley Scott's involvement, Denis Villeneuve's going to expand this world too greatly. I think he's going to stay to those kind of core questions of humanity and
right.
what makes us human, you know, very
artificial
very
intelligence,
large, you know, scale sci-fi questions that were brought up in Blade Runner. But I do wonder what the Ryan Gosling angle will be. Are we going to do the same thing over again? And is this just going to be another one of those franchise handoffs that Harrison Ford did with Star Wars and Indiana Jones? Or
right.
Are we going to get something different?
I really hope not. I don't think that – I mean, my instinct will tell me that I don't think the Blade Runner 2049 is going to be a straight-up franchise handoff. In fact, I'd be surprised after this if actually did one more than this. But certainly possible. I really am hoping that there's probably some new questions asked. I think that the world we're living in now versus when the first one was produced is fairly different. I think that they've already, at least in the trailer, going back to that, you know, how the world looks then, maybe a wider divide between rich and poor. Certainly the shelter scene that we saw briefly in the most recent trailer seemed to suggest that people are worse off than they were before. Not just cramped and claustrophobic living on top of each other in cities, but actually living in, like I said, shelters. So hopefully there's some new world building, or at least a bit building on top of the one from the original Blade Runner. And like I said, I really hope there are some new questions, not just about the, you know, the nature of intelligence, the nature of, you know, being human. And I just hope Jared Leto does not ruin it, because he certainly can.
I know. And he's so prevalent in the trailers. It's just like, oh God. But there's the cast looks uniformly excellent, and the aesthetic is seems spot on. Denis Villeneuve seems like the perfect director
he does.
To take this forward. And with Ridley Scott kind of heavily involved, I really hope that the long runtime doesn't mean we're getting some larger Blade Runner mythology. I just hope it means we get potentially just a larger scope, like a slightly larger scope. Because that's what Ridley Scott has fallen prey to with Alien Covenant and Prometheus. He decided to expand the scope of the alien world, and in fact just made it so much uglier in a way, and denser, and the mystery was actually more fun when we didn't know where these aliens came from, when we didn't know that the Prometheans were this, like, master race that had created humanity. Like, that kind of world building I really hope they avoid.
Yeah.
And I think they will. But, you know, the blind speculation will be fun for a couple weeks, because we get to see it roughly in a week. I actually think that is probably a good place to wrap this first pod, because if we dive into four more of these, I'm not sure we will make it in under 2 hours. But as these movies come out and as we see them, this is absolutely something that we're going to come back to. We will absolutely dog these movies. We will hate on Jared Leto, along with our loyal 12 listeners that we hopefully get over the coming weeks and months. And
12 would be a very, very high number. I don't know why I picked 12.
It's going to be a very, like,
that's a really stupid
12-man joke.
Yeah,
but,
that's not
that wasn't my intent. But I think for this first one, this is probably a good place to wrap. Boss Hog and Pod number one in the tank.
Yeah, title is a work in progress. Although I do love Boss Hog.
Yes. We will probably be back between the Titans and Colts game to give kind of our recap and impressions, and we will actually be attending the Colts game. Yes. So we will definitely have plenty of impressions if we can remember anything after that. So
yeah, maybe watch the film.
Yeah, and for Nick James, this is Ian Dinsmore, and this has been Boss Hoggin, and we will see you folks next time.
You lapdog, we Boss Hoggin.